The largest demonstration ever in the U.S. for Palestinian rights is outside the White House. And what did the Africa Summit really mean for Africa and the U.S.? Coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for August 7th, 2014, here on WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. On the Ground lifts up voices of activists and activism here in the nation's capital. I'm your host, Esther Averam. Well, on today's show, we'll go outside the White House for what on Saturday was called the largest rally ever in the U.S. for Palestinian rights and play remarks at that rally by Cornel West. And with the Africa Summit just concluding, author and activist Gerald Horn will join us to break down what the summit really means for Africa and the U.S. We'll also discuss international law in reference to the assault on Gaza. And, of course, we'll take your calls beginning at the bottom of the hour. But first, our headlines. In West Africa, authorities are struggling to contain a record Ebola outbreak that has killed about 900 people and sickened more than 1,600. Sierra Leone, which has seen the most cases, has vowed to deploy hundreds of soldiers and police to clinics and homes to enforce the isolation of people who may be infected. Palestinian residents of Gaza are returning to massive destruction during an extended ceasefire. Estimates of the reconstruction costs run as high as $6 billion. More than 10,000 homes have been destroyed and more than 5,000 have seen major damage. The Gaza Health Ministry says nearly 1,900 people were killed. Residents have been searching the rubble to retrieve possessions and dig out decomposing bodies. A resident of Rafah said dead children were found. More than 400 children were killed in the Israeli assault. Diplomats from all sides are in negotiations on a lasting agreement beyond the ceasefire. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority officials have met with prosecutors at the International Criminal Court to push for a probe of alleged Israeli crimes. The PA says it will seek ICC membership, a legal step that would grant the court jurisdiction over the occupied territories. John Dugard, former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, told Democracy Now! That as an occupying power, Israel cannot claim self-defense over those it occupies. Dugard also detailed the historical basis for categorizing Israel as an apartheid state. Meanwhile, thousands of people rallied outside the White House on Saturday in protest of U.S. backing for the Israeli assault on Gaza. Some called it the largest rally for Palestinian rights ever held in the U.S. More on the rally after headlines. A medical examiner has made a ruling of homicide in the death of Eric Garner, an African-American father of six who died after police placed him in a chokehold. Police say they confronted Garner because he was selling bootleg cigarettes. Graphic video of the incident shows an officer pulling Garner to the ground by the neck and then holding his head against the pavement. He repeatedly says that he cannot breathe. Garner's family and supporters have called for criminal charges against the officer and a federal civil rights investigation. Hundreds of people have been rallying in Dallas, Texas this week to protest the annual convention. It was actually last week of the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC. The secretive group joins corporate lobbyists with state lawmakers to craft model legislation that is then introduced in legislatures nationwide. Activists have been organizing protests under the banner, "Don't Mess with Texas, ALEC." And yesterday, dozens of home care workers rallied in front of D.C. City Hall to secure unpaid wages. There are up to 5,000 home care workers in the District of Columbia, and many have faced hardships since their employing agencies were cut off from Medicaid funding during the district's fraud investigation earlier this year. In addition to seeking back wages, home care workers said that they are opposing legislation proposed by City Councilwoman Yvette Alexander that would exempt them from the city's living wage law. Currently, home care workers are covered under the law, but many are still not receiving the living wage, which is, as of January 1, $13.60 an hour. in what is being slammed as a hijacking of the democratic process and a cave to pressure by the oil and gas industry. Top Colorado Democrats have pulled two anti-fracking initiatives from the state's November ballot, despite huge grassroots support behind the proposals. On the day, Representative Jared Polis was expected to hand in nearly 300,000 signatures in favor of ballot initiatives that sought to provide greater local control over fracking operations. He announced that he had dropped support for the measures in favor of a deal brokered by Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper. Instead of allowing citizens to vote on shale, oil, and gas drilling in their communities, the politicians announced during a joint press conference that they are establishing a task force led by XTO Energy President Randy Cleveland and taking input from business groups along with the oil and gas industry that will craft drilling regulations. And finally, new figures show that nearly half of the names on the U.S. government's terrorist watch list have no known connections to terrorist groups. Citing leaked figures, the website The Intercept reports that of the 680,000 people included, more than 40% are recognized as having no recognized terrorist group affiliation. The Intercept revealed last month the Obama administration has expanded the watch list system by approving broad guidelines over who can be targeted, asserting that irrefutable evidence or concrete facts are not necessary. The Intercept's report is based on a U.S. intelligence source, prompting the government to acknowledge Tuesday there's at least a second active leaker after Edward Snowden. A movie about Edward Snowden is in the works by director Oliver Stone. According to The Guardian, Stone's film is conceived of as a European co-production and is due to start shooting before the end of 2014. But time is of the essence. Stone's film is set to face competition from No Place to Hide, a rival project adapted from the book by Glenn Greenwald and overseen by James Bond producers Michael Wilson and Barbara Broccoli. Opening in the DMV tomorrow is Finding Fela, the documentary about the life and impact of Nigerian musical icon Fela Kuti. Here is the trailer for Finding Fela.
3, 4.
I am Fela, who no mortal can ever kill. So let us turn Nigeria upside down. I am the law and will do what I please. So yeah, man.
No diplomacy. No compromises, no agreement.
He was an original artist, made a form where there was no form.
When you think of Parliament Funkadelic, Bob Marley's Wailers, Africa 70 was one of the great bands that ever played black music.
He has no fear to get thrown in jail every time a single comes out.
Basically, the idea of Nigeria is that militaries run this place. People were very scared.
And then there's one guy, they say, speaking out against military.
Straight and progressive, clean government that knows what it's doing.
And I knew that this was trouble. Everybody knew this was trouble.
There was so much corruption and so much ziggy-zaggery going on. Fela was a thorn in their flesh. I mean, he was naming names.
Everybody say, yeah, yeah.
Well, I say I didn't die because I have death in my pouch. I can't die. They can't kill me.
He was a synthesizer and he was also a visionary. And at the same time, he's dangerous.
This man just caused trouble for everybody.
By the time he comes out of prison in 86, he was like second only to Nelson Mandela.
What does it mean to be out there in the street caring enough that you're going to stick your neck out again to be punched, stabbed, arrested?
As far as Africa is concerned, music cannot be for enjoyment. Music has to be for revolution.
Music is the weapon.
That was the trailer for Finding Fela. And that will do it for our headlines and for our moment of culture and media today. When we come back, voices from the largest rally for Palestinian rights ever held in the U.S. outside the White House. So we'll be right back. Stay with us.
1, 2, 3. Sherry Simeon.
was Fela Kuti with Let's Start Here on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram. Well, as the death toll and atrocities still mounted in Gaza, a rally believed to be the largest ever for Palestinian rights in the U.S. happened over the weekend outside the White House, sponsored by the Answer Coalition. Those gathered not only opposed the Israeli attack on Gaza, but also U.S. backing for the attacks. Here are some voices from the rally, including those from Iraq Veterans Against the War, WPFW's own Lucy Murphy was there, and ending with author and activist Cornel West.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Yeah, well, we came from Cleveland, Ohio, three buses and a couple of vans, and we came to stop the massacre on Gaza, stop the Israeli genocide of Gaza, tell Obama and Congress to stop funding terrorists, Israeli terrorists, to kill civilians in Gaza and occupation of Palestine. This is our tax dollars. The blood is on Americans' hands, and we need to say stop.
They went to Iraq because they want to control the entire region, not for us, but for banks, for corporations, for oil companies, through violence and domination. And that's why they support Israel. That's why they support Israel. When they can't justify why, it's because they want to control that region, so they use that vicious attack dog to do it.
And brothers and sisters, I just want to say, I'm a U.S. military veteran that has been lied to, just like what Mike said. Many of us have been lied to. I'm also a Jew, and I want to say that that government does not represent me. That U.S. government, which has lied to us, which is complicit in murder, which is complicit in war crimes, does not represent me, and neither does the state of Israel represent me. Okay, we call on Israel to stop the slaughter now. Stop the slaughter now! Free Palestine! Free Gaza! Thank you!
Sorry, Veterans for Peace, thank you for being here. Next, I want to bring up from the Palestinian American Council, Mr. Fadi Zinayed.
We have come with bleeding hearts, with tearing eyes, with bewildered minds and screaming souls at the atrocities committed by Israel.
And for international humanitarian law, how can the U.S. stand by and watch the killing of innocent children on the beach?
We want to tell Obama here on the right side here, where the White House is at, that the Palestinian people have a right to defend themselves. They have a right to resist Israeli terrorism.
And I want to say this, America represents a ship at sea without a captain at the helm. And whichever way the wind blows, and the winds are the handlers of Barack Obama. We all loved him when he came into office. But for him to show weakness in the face of the slaughter in Gaza is appalling. We need to say, Barack, be your own man. You know that it's wrong. You know what people are suffering. You're looking at it on the news every night. You know that collective punishment is against the law. You know that the Israelis have a design. Three wars in 5 years, killing nearly 2,000 Palestinians each time in order to decimate their rank.
My name is Dr. Samia Wasim. I am the president of the local chapter of UPNA, District Maryland and Virginia. I'm here to show solidarity with our Palestinian brothers. And as to know that we are in a healing profession, and we are against killing wherever it is, whenever it is. So please, I'm here to show solidarity with my Palestinian brothers. Free Palestine and free Gaza.
We're here out of a deep, deep love for our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters who are undergoing not just occupation, not just domination, humiliation, not just humiliation, but more and more every day, annihilation, and we won't stand for it. We won't stand 1 minute for it. I come to you in the spirit of the love supreme of John Coltrane and the spirit of Edward Zaid, my dear brother, who tried to tell the truth a long time ago. And we know the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak, just like we have an unapologetic love for those who are wrestling with unbelievable hellish and nightmarish conditions under occupation. We want an end to occupation now. And I come to you also in the spirit of the black prophetic tradition of Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Ella Baker, and others, and they say what? They say Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal, not because he's Jewish, but because he has chosen to promote occupation and annihilation. This is a human affair. Any human being who chooses occupation and annihilation is a war criminal, and especially when they're killing precious Palestinian babies. A Palestinian baby has exactly the same status as a white baby in Newtown, Connecticut, as a brown baby in the east side of LA, as a Jewish baby in Israel. Every human being is made in the image of God. We want the world to know that and know it well, because we know the history of Nakba. We know the history of the catastrophe. We know the history of the 750,000 precious Arabs who were pushed out of 416 villages. We want that story to be told. Let's tell the truth. But let's tell the truth in such a way that we're honest and open. No anti-Jewish hatred here, anti-occupation here, anti-annihilation of anybody here. This is a universal affair, but it begins with our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, whose humanity is rendered invisible in the corporate media, whose humanity is rendered invisible in the stories told. We want to shatter all the lies. There's an intimate connection between mendacity and criminality, between lies and crimes against humanity. And what I want to say to my black brother in the White House, Barack Obama is a war criminal, not because he's black or half African and white, but because his drones have killed 233 innocent children, and because he facilitates the killing of innocent Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, and it would be true anywhere else. And I'm going to be honest with you before I sit down, that I would be here if there were a Palestinian occupation of Jewish brothers and sisters. Because it's wrong, it's unjust, and we stand not with the level of skin pigmentation or ethnic identity. This is ethical, this is spiritual, with political consequences, and that's why we do acknowledge the need for resistance under conditions of occupation and annihilation, and the killing of any innocent civilian is a war crime. But we're now 1,600 and counting. That is what? That is Israeli state terrorism in action. Yeah. And it's Jewish racism in motion. It does not speak on behalf of all the Jewish brothers and sisters who have a choice to say, we're against occupation, we're against annihilation. Let us be together, free Palestine, let Gaza live.
Free Palestine, 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 free Palestine
You just heard voices from the huge rally for Palestinian rights outside the White House on Saturday. The last voice you heard was that of author and activist Cornel West. We're going to take a brief break and come back with the prolific historian, activist, and attorney Gerald Horn. We'll be discussing international law in reference to what the world has witnessed in Gaza and also what this week's Africa Summit here in the nation's capital means for Africa and the U.S. Stay with us. We'll be right back. That was Femi Kute, Truth Don't Die, here on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, where we lift up voices of activists and activism. I'm Esther Averam. Well, for the past 3 days, Washington, D.C. has been the meeting place for more than 40 African leaders. After all the meetings, receptions, business forums, press conferences, and some protests, activists and observers are distilling the meaning of the summit for both Africa and the U.S. With us this morning to help us break it down is the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, a frequent contributor on the Pacifica Network. His newest books are Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, and Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
Welcome back to WPFW.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. In our run-up to the summit last week, we aired a segment including activist Nia Kwete kind of describing what he called the hypocrisy of the summit and the what he called the rogues gallery of dictators and tyrants that were being invited. You know, what is your big takeaway from the summit?
My big takeaway is, surprisingly enough, not inconsistent with that of the mainstream media, insofar as I think the United States is trying to play catch-up ball with regard to China. That is to say, China has made significant inroads in Africa with regard to trade and investment. The United States and its European allies feel that it's falling behind. Now, it's very curious, if not laughable, that the United States, which benefited from the free labor of enslaved Africans for decades, if not centuries, and the European allies, who colonized Africa and looted it and plundered it of its natural resources, are now in the curious position of seeking to warn Africa about the big bad wolf that is presumed to be China. This is not only cynical, it's laughable. The point is, however, that despite all of the rhetoric coming out of this Washington summit, some of the deals are already questionable. For example, the power deal that Mr. Obama talked about, that is to say, erecting these power plants in Africa, is in many ways a giveaway to GE, General Electric, and Jeffrey Immelt, its chairman, the closest allies in the business world of Mr. Obama. The problem is that this power initiative is dependent upon the continued existence of an export-import bank, which the white right in Congress, the so-called Tea Party forces, now have on the chopping block, which calls into question the major takeaway from this much ballyhooed summit. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, it may be possible to say that it was much ado about nothing.
Wow. The you know, I do know that several people have talked about the China connection and basically trying to play catch up. So, you know, but I've also heard people, even African Americans, talk about kind of like, using the argument that, well, you know, I prefer the devil I know. and basically, you know, also kind of jumping on this kind of anti-China bandwagon. You know, how do the deals that China has initiated in Africa differ from those that Africa has with the West?
Well, I would caution our friends in North America to be very wary of jumping on the anti-Beijing bandwagon. You may know that that anti-Beijing bandwagon is hardly a factor on the African continent itself, which raises the possibility of building an unbridgeable gulf between Africa and our comrades and friends in North America. Part of the major difference between Chinese deals and U.S. deals is that China does not tend to interfere as grievously in the internal affairs of sovereign states as the United States of America and its Western European allies. Keep in mind that President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe was not invited to this summit. He was not invited, supposedly because of human rights violations, but then that would call into question why the leaders of Equatorial Guinea, right, Cameroon, and other nations too numerous to mention were present. He was not invited precisely because his party expropriated the land of a European minority and therefore incurred the wrath of the fellow settler colonialists here in North America. Right. This is the example, par excellence, I'm afraid, of how the United States interferes in the internal affairs of sovereign states, which China does not tend to do. Keep in mind also that after decades, if not centuries, of exploitation of Africa, and I might say of the descendants of Africans, enslaved Africans in North America, what do we have to show for it? I mean, those who say the devil we know, I mean, underline devil in that sentence, if you ask me. The fact of the matter is that at least with regard to China, there's infrastructure left behind. Now, there's complaints about what labor, that is to say Chinese labor, is building the infrastructure as opposed to African labor. But when the United States seeks to build bridges and highways and universities and all and airports and the like, well, then perhaps we can compare these two countries. Interesting, as a London reported yesterday,
I think you're kind of breaking up a little bit.
Okay, how's this?
Yes, it's fine.
Yeah, the Financial Times of London reported just yesterday that China is now offering to partner with the United States in building infrastructure in Africa. It seems to me that that's something that Washington should consider. I should also mention that if you look at Brazil, for example, which has the largest population of African descent outside of Nigeria, it's quite curious that as China replaced the United States as Brazil's major trading partner, Brazil soared into the top ranks, the top 10 economies in the world. I don't think that's just correlation. I think that's causation. And I'm afraid that in Washington and on Wall Street, there is fear, perhaps understandable fear, that China is surging ahead in terms of having the largest economy on this small planet. And the United States and its allies, which have relied so heavily on the exploitation of African resources to get to its now fattened position, is now deathly fearful, as well it should be, that China is not going to surpass it and that the Africans are not going to be helping the North Atlantic nations compete with China effectively.
You know, I'm just curious also, I just thought about the BRICS, a meeting that was held in Brazil, and their formation of an alternative kind of international bank, or how is that connected to the Africa summit and the West's, you know, perhaps nervousness about that coalition that I think includes China, along with Brazil, Russia, India, and South Africa. Yeah, South Africa.
Yes. Well, I think that there is concern about the new development bank, as it's called, which came out of the BRICS summit in Fortaleza, Brazil, just a few weeks ago. The fact of the matter is that Congress has been sitting on a proposal for months, if not years, to reform the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to have it reflect more directly the present correlation of forces globally and economically. That is to say, giving more voting power to China and its allies. That is to say that as of now, you have certain small Western European nations like the Netherlands and Belgium that carry as much clout and voting weight in those two multilateral bodies as China does and as Brazil does, which is obviously ludicrous.
Wow.
Not only that, but when we in here in North America push for example, quotas for representation in higher education, we're told that that violates the principle of meritocracy. But if you look at the World Bank, by fiat, the head of the World Bank is a U.S. national. By fiat, the head of the International Monetary Fund is a Western European, now Christine Lagarde of France. What happened to meritocracy? Why can't an Australian or an African or a Brazilian or a Chinese person be head of these two important organizations?
Right.
So rather than reform the and incorporate the developing nations like China, the U.S. and its allies turn their back, and then they get upset when China and its allies try to build an alternative.
Right.
Now,
Gerald, we want you to hold that thought. We have to go to a brief break right now and invite our listeners to call in at 202-588-0893. Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
We've got some blues you can use. Join WPFW for an all-day concert featuring the best in blues and southern soul music on Saturday, August 9th. It all starts at noon with many of your favorite local artists like Stacey Brooks, Jim Bennett and Lady Mary, Terrence McArdle and his jumping band, Anthony Swamp Dog Clark, and more. Closing out the day's activities is a legendary Big Daddy Stallings out of Baltimore, giving you good time blues with a twist. We're also going to pay tribute to Da Gator, our very own curator of southern soul music. Tickets are $25. To purchase tickets, visit us online at WPFW.org or call 202-588-0999 extension 344. Don't miss your chance to hear some down-home blues at WPFW, baby.
Lamont's Entertainment Complex is located at 4400 Livingston Road in Indian Head, Maryland. 89.3 FM, WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on the mighty WPFW 89.3, your station for jazz and justice, your listener-powered station here in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Rivera, and I'm speaking with author and activist Gerald Horn about the just-concluded Africa Summit here in D.C., related topics on the continent and Gaza. And it's also your turn to call in at 202-588-0893 to comment on the Africa Summit, Africa and Gaza. That's 202-588-0893. Please, if you've already called the station this week, please refrain from calling and allow someone else an opportunity. Professor Horn, you were speaking about we were talking about BRICS and this kind of relationship between the joining together of many developing economies to form their own bank and how that might be related to the summit.
Well, look at Ghana, the West African nation to which we in North America have been quite close since the days of Kwame Nkrumah, the founding father. Ghana is going through a very severe crisis right now financially, and it is now going to the International Monetary Fund to seek assistance. Do not be surprised that as a result of getting assistance from the IMF, that the Ghanaian government will be forced to cut subsidies, for example, with regard to education, for example, or health care.
Right.
As a result of this Fortaleza summit, an alternative is being built to the International Monetary Fund to which a Ghana would be able to turn and would not be compelled to cut subsidies to education and health care. This brings up the major point, which is that those of our friends who are now complaining about China should realize that African nations have more leverage when they can not only go to Brussels and Washington for assistance, when they can go to Beijing and Brasilia for assistance. So our friends in many ways are taking an anti-African position when they're basically saying the Africans only have one door to knock on, and that's
right.
In Washington. Which is obviously ridiculous.
Right. Okay, well, we have our lines filled up, folks calling in, and you can do the same at 202-588-0893. We'll go to our first caller. Caller, just tell me your first name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, Dr. Horn. Good morning, Esther. Tespa calling from Arlington.
Hi, Tespa.
The criteria by which they selected some to come to D.C. and avoid others is very worrying, because Ethiopia kids by the State Department's annual report, 80,000 political prisoners. Just last week, the Ethiopian TV was showing a person tortured and some others behind the person on TV crying from torture, and still they invited the president and the prime minister of Ethiopia, and this is, I cannot believe that in the United States, and this is what the United States has come to. And if they bring heads of states of the ones like the Ethiopian ones, which torture people on TV, show it on TV, then what do you expect the result of the relationship with of the United States with these countries?
Okay.
We're going to have torture in Africa supported by the United States. That's what it has come to.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Tess, for that call. Next, just caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Morami, and I'm from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And as we have a quick comment, the guest that you have online is a very brilliant intellectual, and I ask if he can please give the full spelling of his first name and last name, because every book that he has written and has placed on the market, I am purchasing it, and that is my goal, every single book that he.
Oh, okay. We're speaking with Gerald Horn. We're speaking with Gerald Horn, and that's G-E-R-A-L-D Horn, H-O-R-N-E, Gerald Horn, a frequent Pacifica contributor and, you know, professor at University of Houston. And so was that all the comment you wanted to make, or? Okay. All right. So we'll go to our next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
This is Sarah. I'm calling from Washington, D.C., and I want to thank you for your great program. I haven't been listening to WPFW for a while because I was kind of disappointed with the rhetoric. But this program that you had today gave me the hope that WPFW is going back to the tradition of talking for justice, especially
maybe just try to speak up a little bit more for me. I think
I wanted to thank you for letting us listen to Professor Cornel West. He's a brilliant, brilliant mind, and I am so glad that I had the opportunity to listen to his speech.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for listening in and for calling in today. Do we have another caller? Okay, caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from. Okay, we may have missed that caller, but you could call back if you like. Professor Horn, you're still with us?
Yes.
So I wanted to turn some of our attention to Gaza. Our last caller actually was thanking us for playing Cornel West's address at the big demonstration outside the White House on the weekend, and and the demonstration was a little different than some of the demonstrations that people might know about, because it was actually kind of talking about U.S. support and how we are complicit by our sending arms, sending millions of dollars a day to Israel. And so I wanted to kind of talk about the legal aspects of this. A clip from John Dugard, the former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine. And he told Democracy Now! That not only is Israel an apartheid state, but that it has no right to defend itself from a people it is occupying. So I'm going to play that clip and then get your response to that.
If I look at the situation in Palestine, which I know very well as former Special Rapporteur, if I look at it as a former South African, then I see very similar circumstances prevailing in Palestine as prevailed in South Africa during apartheid. But I think it's also important to look at the situation in terms of the 1973 United Nations Convention on the Suppression of Apartheid, which defines apartheid and which applies it to situations beyond Southern Africa. And essentially it requires three conditions. First of all, that there should be two groups. Here there are clearly two groups, the Palestinians and the Israelis. Secondly, that the dominant group should commit inhumane acts against the subject group, and that clearly is happening in the occupied Palestinian territory. Israel has subjected the Palestinians to all sorts of inhumane acts. And then thirdly, this should be done with the intention of maintaining domination. And one can draw that influence from the presence of settlers in the West Bank, because today one has some 600,000 settlers in the West Bank. You actually constitute a colonial enterprise. And as with all colonies, the colonial peoples or the colonial power subjects the colonized people to domination. And so if one looks at these three conditions, I think it's clear that in terms of the 1973 Convention on Apartheid, Israel's policies and practices in the occupied Palestinian territory are tantamount to apartheid.
That was John Dugard, former UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine. And, you know, he said several things there. One of the things I didn't kind of pre-announce was the fact that he talked about kind of Israel as a colonizer. So, Gerald, what is your response to his comments?
I think he hit the nail on the head. And I think what we need to understand is why and how it is that in Washington, the U.S. Senate voted unanimously to support Israel's criminal aggression, and why we have heard hardly a peep from the self-proclaimed conscience of the Congress. I'm speaking of the Congressional Black Caucus. I think the reason lies in part not only with the power and influence of the Israeli lobby in Washington, but also the fact that the United States itself is a settler colonial regime. And preparation for speaking in Atlanta this weekend, I was doing some background reading on the history of Georgia, and the dispossession of the Cherokees in Georgia is quite similar to the dispossession of the Palestinians. That is to say that many Cherokees 170 years ago would come home and find some people, typically Euro-Americans, occupying their homes and telling them they had nowhere to go. The same thing happened in Palestine approximately 60 to 70 years ago. Until we grasp that nettle, I think we won't be able to understand what's going on in terms of the lethargy in Congress, nor be able to effectively confront the criminal aggression of the Israeli occupier.
Okay, we have a few callers on the line. We're going to take them in, but stay with us, okay? Caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Yes, Hotep. My name is Tehudi Ani Patah Hotep. I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia. I also would like to say Hotep to Brother Gerald Horn and the PFW listening audience. Yes, with the murder of Muammar Gaddafi and destruction of Libya, with the rest of the Arab nations that surround Israel and in the Mideast, and the destruction or the division of the Sudan by dividing it up into a South and a North Sudan, all of these operations that were really a operation by the American and European forces, along with the Zionists in Israel, is another attempt to now colonize the whole continent of Africa. As a matter of fact, that whole movement called ISIS that is supposed to be setting up a Muslim caliphate right there in the Middle East, how come they will attack every Muslim nation and you will never hear about them attacking Israel?
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you, Tehudi. Gerald, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I think the caller makes a solid point with regard to Libya and ISIS. I would tell the Obama administration that they should observe the principles of medicine. First, do no harm. Because they did grievous harm when they launched the bombing attack against Libya in 2011. This not only created a situation of chaos in Libya that has spread into Mali and has had negative knock-on effects in Niger and also in Chad, but also has spread to Nigeria with the Boko Haram being strengthened, which of late has kidnapped the wife of the number two leader in Cameroon. It seems to me that in terms of the security and governance agenda of this African summit, the African leader should have told Mr. Obama that he should stop this very curious relationship that the United States has with these religious extremists, because they knew that religious extremists would surge to influence and power in Benghazi and Tripoli once Gaddafi was eliminated.
Right.
And they also knew that by trying to destabilize Syria, that they would strengthen the religious extremists like the Islamic State and al-Nusra Front.
Right. Okay, we have another caller. Tell me your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, yes. I'm calling from Baltimore. My name is Youssef.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Horn.
Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to call and thank you, man. You were in Baltimore. You came to Baltimore recently and at Red Emma's. And man,
right, at Red Emma's, right.
Yeah, yeah. And, Doc, I just want to thank you for the courageous insight and your ability to bring things clearly to us. Your sense of history and your sense of current events is just so important to us, and thank you. And we hope to see you back at Red Emma's or in Baltimore again soon, or D.C.
Oh, wow. Thank you for calling, Youssef. Caller, have another caller? Oh, no? Okay. Well, you know, you had a fan come in. He doesn't know that you're a prolific reader. I remember we had to pick you up for when we were still doing the AM alternative, and you wanted to know if the gas station had the Financial Times. I thought that was pretty funny. But I'm curious about the whole role of the international court. And, you know, why, for example, war crimes charges of war crimes, you know, aren't successfully brought against Israel, not just this time, but in the last attack a couple years ago and then 4 years before that. And how come the ongoing occupation and siege isn't also a war crime? I want to kind of get to some of the legal aspects of it.
Well, first of all, it's obviously a double standard, just like the International Criminal Court in The Hague disproportionately indicts and prosecutes leaders of Africa and also leaders of formerly socialist states. That shows where their agenda lies. I'm speaking of the former Yugoslavia, of course. It's quite curious that the so-called responsibility to protect doctrine initiated by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, which says that the international community has the right to intervene and override sovereignty if civilians in a regime are being abused, supposedly, that helped to undergird the intervention in Libya in 2011. But obviously, civilians in Gaza, a country that is under occupation, are being severely abused and massacred, even according to French analysts who usually side with Israel. So why isn't the responsibility to protect doctrine invoked? Basically, what's happening is that international law is being left in tatters. It's becoming a caricature of itself. And we know the reason is because the United States, in particular, stands as the number one protector of the criminal regime that is Israel.
You know, I want to follow up that thought in a second, but I want to go to another caller we have. Just call it. Just tell me your first name and where you're calling from.
Yeah, this is Sarah again. I'm sorry my line was gone. I couldn't finish what I was planning to say.
Okay, thanks for calling back.
Yeah. What I wanted to say is that, Professor Conor West mentioned, this movement, I mean, shows that many, many thousands of people were in that demonstration because I was there.
Yes.
And then this shows that many people are against the United States policy, and I have seen Jewish people among the demonstrators. But I think we need more Jewish voices being actively involved and doing something, because we shouldn't watch this human catastrophe in Palestine. I mean, there is a lot going on everywhere around the world, which I think basically is because of the terrorist activities around the world. But this shouldn't take our focus away from the Palestine, because that's the main catastrophe right now, which is the center of attention. And I think we should organize, do something, because right now, after all this massacre, people are ready to accept any kind of action. They are ready to do something.
Yes.
And I think this energy needs to be mobilized and do something to end this misery, because this is ruining the image of Jewish people. I think they should be actively involved in ending this policy of terror in Gaza and in Palestine.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling. We have one more caller we can take. Caller, just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Hey, this Freedom from D.C. Just real quick, I just want to say to Brother Mr. Horn, probably part of the reason, maybe he can just respond to this, Andrew Young said, Ambassador Andrew Young said yesterday on the radio station that the position, or one of the positions of the government, is that Hamas or Palestine should stop being jealous, stop irritating Israel. Stop being jealous of Israel, stop irritating them, with complete disregard for anything about the life and death of these Palestinian children. So you, I just want to put that in the conversation to add on to what you're saying, but you can respond if you would.
Wow. Are you, can you, do you want to respond, Gerald?
Well, I mean, obviously that cannot be taken seriously. We know that Andrew Young has made a small fortune leaving political office, and his contracts in his business are heavily dependent upon the good wishes and goodwill of many pro-Israel and pro-Zionist supporters. We also know that Hamas has the right, under international law, to fight an illegal occupation. Mm-hmm. We also know, coincidentally enough, that Israel, some years ago, was instrumental in helping to bring Hamas into being, because Israel, at that point, was more concerned about left-leaning groups like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And so we'd say to Israel, you reap what you sow.
Okay. I think I might be able to take one more caller. Go ahead. Just say your first name and where you're calling from. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. About the Palestinian conflict, the Israelis keep talking about they're defending themselves, but yet they went into Gaza with armor and tanks and everything else, and they lost more men in the conflict, in the incursion into Gaza, than they had with the Hamas sending the rockets into Israel.
Okay.
Where they only lost 3 civilians.
Okay.
So my question is, how can they say that? If the dome working so well, why do you have to even send anybody in there to take out what?
Right. Well, thank you for that call. We actually won't be able to respond to it because we have to kind of wind down right now. But I thank you know, my guest, Professor Gerald Horn, for being with us this morning. And my engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you, caller, and all the callers for calling in for what I thought was a really good discussion and community discussion. And so that'll do it for us today on the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Stay tuned for Askia Muhammad with the news, followed by Krista Property, and don't forget the blues. Thanks again, Gerald.
You.
Okay. Peace.